Entree Architect Foundations is a collection of more than 50 business forms and checklists designed and built specifically for you, the small firm architect. Learn more at entrearchitect.com/foundations. You are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, and this is episode 212. Welcome back to Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and this is the podcast dedicated to a successful life as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Whether you have plans to someday start your own firm, you're in the process of launching a startup, or you may be an experienced small firm architect just like me, just trying to make a difference, this podcast is for you. My goal is to inspire you to build a better business so that you may pursue your purpose with passion and live the life of your dreams. In 1986, Carlo Petrini protested the opening of a McDonald's restaurant in Piazza di Spagna in Rome and launched the slow food movement. Carl Honore explains in his book, In Praise of Slowness, that slow food stands for everything that McDonald's does not. Fresh, local, seasonal produce, recipes handed down through the generations, sustainable farming, artisanal production, leisurely dining with family and friends. But ultimately, the movement is about the sensual pleasures of food. 30 years after Carlo's protest, organic produce, artisanal cheeses, and craft beer are everywhere. Foodies flock to ever more specialized restaurants serving only food cultivated in their own backyards. Whole Foods is considered mass market, and Michelle Obama is promoting farm to table in public schools. Carlo should be proud. He saved food. Since then, the slow movement has touched almost every industry except ours. Slow cities, slow aging, slow religion, slow cinema, slow education, slow sex, slow medicine, slow fashion, slow parenting, slow travel. Architecture, design, and the building industry are conspicuously absent from this list. Until now. This week at Entree Architect Podcast, the slow space movement with architect Mehta Omot of Omot Plum Architects. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by our longtime platform sponsors, RCAT, FreshBooks, and Core by BQE Software. And I'm going to share more about these great companies later, so listen up. But before we get started, just take a quick note right now. Go put it in your iPhone or jot it down. Go say hi to them. Go check them out. RCAT, FreshBooks, Core by BQE. Let them know that you appreciate them for supporting us here at the Entree Architect Podcast, because they are supporting you, the Entree Architect community. Mehta Omot, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. I recently posted on the Entree Architect community Facebook group for requests on who we want to hear on the podcast here. And your name came back several times. And so I wanted to reach out to you and say hi and bring you on the show and share your story, share what you're doing. I did a little research on who you are and what you're doing, and I'm excited about this conversation. I think this is going to be a really fun conversation. So thank you for being here.
Well, yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks again to everybody who, asked for this interview. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, good. Let me introduce you a little bit to our listeners who don't know who you are. Mehta Omot is an architect, CEO, and co-founder of Omot Plum, an architecture and interiors and construction firm in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She's a former AIA member, which is interesting, a design activist and co-founder of the Slow Space Movement to promote good, clean, and fair buildings for all. She publishes biweekly thought pieces on her blog, slowspace.org, which is maybe where you know her from. To explore ideas around slow space and slow architecture, which we're going to get into later and what that is. She's also a mother of two, together with her husband and partner, Andrew Plum. And she was also diagnosed with MS in 2002 upon graduation from Harvard's GSD, to the Graduate School of Design. So that's sort of who you are in a nutshell, Metta. Let's dive into an origin story. Let's learn a little bit more about you. Go back as far as you want to go back. Whatever inspired you to become an architect, share that story to where you find yourself today.
Okay, great. Well, yeah, I'm really looking forward to this conversation. That'll be fun. Thinking all the way back. So going all the way back, of course, it goes back to my parents. And my parents did not want me to be an architect. They taught me that architecture was a really tough business. My father is an architect.
Oh, there you go. I knew somebody was an architect in there.
Exactly. And my mother was a business person. And so I remember lots of highs and lows, recessions, things like that. Of course, since they told me not to be an architect, that's of course what I did. So you should always use reverse psychology with your kids. So yeah. Remember that. That's lesson number one. So I found my way to architecture kind of through a long path. I originally started out in urban planning, and they were thrilled with that. That was acceptable, and then eventually ended up in architecture at the GSD, which was grueling. And I graduated from the GSD with an MArch and with MS. So that was multiple sclerosis. Not the good letters, not the good kind of letters after my name. But that's also where I met my partner and husband, Andrew. So that was another positive thing that came out of it. Thank God for that. So when we graduated, yes, I was diagnosed. I got MS sometime during architecture school. All the stress, I'm sure, was a trigger for nobody knows how you get it, but it was a trigger. I was definitely stressed out. And about like 2 weeks before, or maybe it was a week before my thesis review, I went blind in my right eye. I couldn't hold my X-Acto to do the to cut the little tiny pieces for my model anymore. And I just thought I was stressed out. It was like, right. Oh, I can't see out of that eye. Oh, I'll deal with that later.
Right. It must be stress, right?
It must be stress.
Yeah. I mean, the life of an architecture student.
Yeah, exactly. And so like Andrew helped out, my friends helped out, and then I went to the doctor, and it was a lot worse than I thought. So Andrew and I were starting our careers as architects, and we, with this kind of horrible diagnosis, just, from the get-go, like, okay, now what am I going to do? Like, how is this going to affect me? I have no idea. I didn't know anything about the disease. I didn't know anything about how it was going to, what kind of disability I was going to have, like nothing. I knew I was burned out, though. I knew I was totally already fried starting my career, and I was already kind of at zero. Yeah. We weren't sure what to do because we really believed in the power of architecture and the power of it to make it an impact on people's lives. But we saw how much it sucked to be an architect and what little value our society places on architecture. We have so little market share, only 2%, they say, of buildings are designed by an architect. And that's even worse in residential construction, where there's really not a mandate, at least in public projects and institutional projects, you have to by law have an architect, but not so in residential. So we were faced with this, sort of dilemma of how are we going to do good work, have a good life, and make a good living. Well, we kept asking people that, and they were essentially like, "Yeah, that's not possible." It's like, yeah, you pick two out of three.
What did mom and dad say at that point?
No, I didn't ask them. I had made my bed. So, I love a good challenge. And so, like, since then, it was really like we weren't willing to give up any one of those things, even though all the avenues, all the sort of regular avenues appeared as though you had to give up one of those things in order to progress. So after a couple of years of working, we were lucky enough to be able to start our own firm so we could really try to figure out how to do things differently. And the sort of not business as usual was our motto. Like, you know, how are we going to do this in a way that's different from the way all the other architects are doing it? Because the way that they're doing it is not working out.
Right.
It's not going to get us towards our triple threat of, you know, good work, good life, good money. So we started looking to other business, to the business world and other industries, and just started reading a ton, tons of business books, and, you know, trying to learn everything we could about, you know, how to run a firm, how to run a profitable firm. So like, you know, okay, 10 years later, like, what are some of the things that we've, you know, and it's all been trial and error, of course, because all we had was our own learning and our own sort of efforts and, you know, mistakes to learn from.
Yeah, there's no place to learn it. That's why I launched Entree Architect, because we wanted to fill that void and create a place where small firms can learn what you had to learn on your own.
Exactly. Exactly. And this was 10 years ago. Where were you then?
Right,
you know,
right.
It's like,
I was there, but I was really, really small.
Right. Exactly. So we figured out a few things, you know, in the process, or, you know, we're constantly just trying things, you know, everyone that works with us is there's no like sort of, status quo. We're constantly innovating on the, you know, on the design side, but also on the business side. So, you know, we do things like we specialize as opposed to trying to do a little bit of everything. So we specialize in homes, almost exclusively. It took us a while to like even be able to, like, that was a hard pill to swallow.
Yeah,
like,
that's a common theme on the podcast and in my community. I call it the target market. You have to pick a target market, and we get pushback on that all the time because everybody wants to do everything.
Everyone wants to do everything. Most
successful firms are the ones that find a place, find a target, and focus on that.
Right. And you know, you can be successful if you focus on it, because we found that every time we switched project types, there was a huge learning curve.
Right.
It was apples and oranges. I mean, we did public housing. The bidding process for that has nothing to do with private residential. You know, commercial specs have nothing to do with residential specs. It's like a whole different industry.
Right.
So you're never going to make any money if you're reinventing the wheel every time you get a new project. So our goal is to be profitable, and so that we can, and I'll talk about that later, so we can leverage that position as a profitable firm to make a greater impact. So, but first we need to solve the money problem.
Yep.
Because if we're not in business, we can't do anything. And if we're sick and, you know, and broke, you know, we can't do anything. And if we're doing shitty work also, like, what's the point?
Right.
So none of those things were things we were going to sacrifice. So specializing was one. Then we recently decided to become an architect-led design build firm. So we specialize in the houses, and so rather than the crazy, you know, combative relationship we have with builders now, if we just do the whole thing, then all of a sudden, for my one marketing dollar, I got one client, but then I got so much more scope out of that same client than I did before. We also do the interior, so it's like a soup to nuts thing. But
yep.
The best part is that our clients love it because the process is such a mess without it.
Yep.
And it's so antagonistic and it's so complicated. And so we just take care of it for everybody. And it's like a win-win, because we don't have to go through all the, you know, all the kind of paperwork during CA, all the cover your ass stuff with, you know, submittals and things like that. It's one hand talking to the other hand. We're all in the same office. It's like, it's a revelation, you know, and this is, again, a way to, like, streamline what is a really overcomplicated process, a very difficult value proposition to sell to a client. Here, hire us to design this house. You have no idea what it's going to look like. You have no idea how long it's going to take, and you have no idea how much it's going to cost.
Right.
Right? Wow. That's
and they think that your fee is one-tenth of what it really is.
Well, yeah. And so, you know, but when you start from that, like nobody could sell that, you know? I mean, that's like impossible. You know, the just custom home building and residential design is a difficult sell. And, you know, it puts us into like this very, very niche, and I would call say even elitist kind of pocket, where you know, doing the architecture alone meant that the projects had to be of a certain size in order for us to make any money on it. So we had to turn away people that would have been great clients, but their projects were just too small and the scale wouldn't work out. But now that you know, like the effort to reward ratio wouldn't really work out. We'd end up losing money. But if we design it and build it, then we have a much better opportunity to recoup some of our upfront investment and earn money, you know, at the end. We can help more people. And so it was kind of killing us that the only people we could work with were really wealthy people, you know, designing fancy houses for wealthy people. You can be very profitable doing that. But we wanted to make a bigger impact, and go beyond that.
How are you providing the construction?
So we brought on a partner, and who is, you know, has 15, 20 years experience as a construction manager with a great interest in architecture, wanted to become an architect, and, you know, went a different route. So we had worked with him before on a project where he was a builder on one of the projects that we designed. Great guy. So we brought him in, and we formed a sister company. So he runs the jobs. Well, he runs the business that then runs the jobs.
Right. Okay, good. Great, great. Because there's lots of different ways to do that. And so I wanted to see how you're doing it. And that seems to be the most successful route, is to team up with somebody who's already done it, start a second company, let that person lead that company, and then you work together as a team. So, you know, in a strategic way, you're one firm, but technically and legally, you're two firms, right?
That's the way we figured out we had to do it,
Yeah.
because you couldn't get like builder as an architect, you can't get
Right.
builder's insurance, and you know, and vice versa. So we are Omot Plum as a, you know, as a brand,
Yep.
and then we provide these different services, and the sort of we're trying to make it in a way that there is no meaningful difference between, you know, the separate companies. Everything is just one.
Right.
But yes, for
It's a legal technicality.
it's a
It's
technicality. Yeah.
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 So you're essentially one firm providing design and construction,
Yes.
and the process, and from the client's point of view, there's no seam at all. It's seamless.
It's totally seamless. One check, one point of responsibility, one, you know, one phone call to make when there's something goes wrong, you
So
know.
if there's one check, is that check being written to the architecture firm, and then the architecture firm is paying the construction firm? How do you do that
Actually,
financially?
it has to go the other
The
way
other way around.
around.
So it's you're paying they're paying the contractor side of it, and then they pay the design side of it. Got it. Okay.
And so, again, this is a way to just a way to do things differently, you know, and to try to meet the needs and be able to serve more people by making this process that is, you know, really difficult, a little bit easier. I mean, I also, you know, I have a guide on my website that's like how to hire an architect and like try to lay the steps out for people. Just so that was the first pass, is like providing information. You know, and just to like try to demystify, you know, but then when we were finding that we were, you know, we couldn't help people, certain people, because it just the project wasn't big enough, you know, that was frustrating to us. We needed the work, but you know, the formula didn't work out.
So are you also giving them one fee up front? So one proposal for the whole package?
There's one proposal for the whole package. Yeah, there's one contract for the entire thing. And AIA has a document. I think it's for 145. And so, yeah, there's one contract for the entire thing. There's an amendment, like after the design phase, when the construction fee is known. And so that's an amendment that kind of triggers the start of construction.
Okay, great. That's
Yeah.
a, and so how long have you been doing that, the construction side?
We just started last year, and so you know, we're still kind of within the first year of doing it, and
Were there any surprises that you didn't expect, both good and bad, by doing that?
all the surprises have been good. I
That's
mean, all everything is, you know, there's so much that's bad about the typical design bid build relationship, and
Yeah.
we've kind of gone through the ringer already. Our very first project, you know, we got a great opportunity to design this great beach house, and we really really stretched the design. The whole thing was out of cast in place concrete, and you know, we had a lifetime's worth of experience in just doing that very first project. You know, design bid build. At the end of the project, the contractor sued everybody, you know, including us.
Yep.
So our very first project, we get sued.
Yay.
So yay.
Welcome to architecture.
Right? You know, and it's kind of like, well, this sucks. You know, we get sued in federal court because we don't have an agreement with the contractor. We were out of state. You know, I mean, it's a nightmare. Of course, we got sued for doing what we were supposed to do, because we literally did that entire project with the Architect's Handbook of Professional Practice open on the desk, reading it like, okay, by the book, how are we supposed to do this? Like, you know, and. So, yeah, so, you know, it is sort of, so we knew that doing it like the business as usual way is really broken and has lots of problems. And, you know, there's got to be room for innovation here. There's got to be lots of room. So anyway, so the goal of, you know, running a profitable firm and doing good work is, you know, that's a challenge in and of itself. And that's a great challenge. But what we wanted to be able to do is get to that point so we could leverage that position to the position of being a profitable firm to have a greater impact. And our mission is to improve the lives of 1 million people by creating good, clean, and fair homes. Now, the 1 million is a arbitrary but large arbitrary number, and it's intentionally large to get us thinking at scale and thinking about impact way beyond what we could do. Like, maybe now we could help 12 people a year, you know, over 40 years. That's 48 people. Oh, wow. It's like, wow. Is that really, like, is that all I was really meant to do? And so, you know, one way to have that kind of an impact, there's two approaches, at least two that I've come up with so far. One is the bottom-up approach, and that's starting a movement. And that's really changing ideas and changing minds. And so that's the genesis of the slow space movement, you know, looking at how much is wrong with our industry, design and construction, particularly in residential, and you know, where we just the you know p consumers don't have options. They have McMansions, and we're, you know, us architects, we kind of are like poo-poo it and we snicker, but we never go beyond that.
Yeah, we
You,
don't do anything about it.
we don't do anything about it. And you know, the majority of, you know, again, we can't help people. Like, the custom home building process, it takes so long, and financing is difficult and all that kind of stuff. But most people are not willing to wait 2 years for to move into their house. I mean, that's a ridiculous proposition in and of itself, right? Most people, they need to move, or they want to move, or they want a house. You know, they want to buy a house and then move in. 3 months, right, is what it takes, or 6 months, let's say. That's what like a production builder would do. That would be like the turnaround time for, you know, a production builder or something like that. Like, that's a reasonable amount of time, even 9 months, maybe, you know, a little
And
longer.
that's the whole process. That's
That's the
like
whole process.
from
That's
their
from
decision to
design.
move into a new house to moving into the new house.
Exactly. And so, you know, and so, so they don't have any other options. The custom option isn't an option, really, when you're working on a time frame of 6 months, which is a reasonable time frame. And so that isn't an option. So what's an option is what's already out there, and what's already out there is crap. And you know, it's McMansions, all the new stuff, because I mean I'm in Boston and people love the old houses here, but you know, not in the rest of the country. You know, my in-laws kind of like, "What? You bought a 100-year-old house? Why would you do that?"
Right. I'm in the process. We're in New York, just above New York City. We live in a house that's from the 30s, but we're in the process of moving to Charlotte, North Carolina. Charlotte, North Carolina is booming right now, and it's all builder houses.
Yeah.
Miles and acres and acres and acres and acres of the same McMansion houses, all at different price points, but it's all that same stuff that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And every corner is a commercial, that same commercial corner, the same Target, the same Walmart, the same
Yeah.
Panera Bread on every corner for acres and acres and miles and miles.
Yeah. And so, you know, so there's so what well, so what's wrong with the McMansion? I mean, there's lots of things that are wrong with it from a design perspective, and your audience is all architects, so I don't need to go into this, but let's just say poor design,
Yeah.
right? Let's take that as a given. But then let's talk about the other two points. And this good, clean, and fair is something I borrowed from the slow food
Yeah,
movement.
actually, before you get into it,
Yeah.
explain slow space and where
Okay.
that came from.
Okay. So slow space is it exists as two things in our mind at Omaat Plum. And on the one hand, it's our kind of esoteric like design philosophy, and on the other hand, it's a very practical social movement. And so and in my blog, I kind of get into both. Like, I have some articles that where I'm like talking about this sort of philosophy and metaphysics of space, the space-time continuum, which I'm really fascinated by, you know. And then on the same on the you know on the same same blog, but you know, different article, I'll be talking about like, you know, what makes a how do I define a clean building, you know. So two kind of very different realms that I'm still kind of grappling with, but I'm still very much interested in both. But in terms of making it like a larger movement, you know, I wanted to, you know, this idea of, well, number one, like, you know, I'm an architect just like you. What do we know about like social movements? Nothing. So, you know, it's great to model it off of something else that has been a successful movement. And then the whole idea of the slow movement just fit so well with Andrew and my philosophy on life and the way that we needed to go about doing things in a very slow, methodical way. I mean, we are the proverbial tortoise that is, you know, kind of doing our paces, you know, getting one step at a time, getting there, you know, but there were never any hype or fanfare or anything like that, you know. We had other friends that started firms, you know, around the same time, got lots of publicity, and we were kind of like, oh, you know, be a little jealous. And it's like, that's just not us, you know. We are just like pretty down to earth and straight shooters, and just like, we're just going to plod along here, and we're just going to do our thing. Slow and steady wins the race. And the more we started thinking about the analogy, the more like it kind of perfect it was. Just the whole idea of it just blends so well with our interest in the experience of space, as opposed to the sort of objectification of architecture that's been so prevalent the last 20 years, and what it looks like, and you know, the kind of sexy image you can put up on, you know, on a, you know, in a magazine or on an online blog or something like that. You know, we're interested in how do the spaces feel? How do they make you feel? You know, what's the phenomenological, you know, experience
It's
of the
like
space?
the antithesis of the developer house, right? I mean,
Well, it is,
if
which
the if
is.
the, the developer house is this, get it up as fast as you can. It doesn't matter about quality. It doesn't matter about design. Just give them square footage. Give them the number of bedrooms they're looking for, and let's get on to the next one. The
Exactly.
slow space movement sounds like that. Slow it down. Let's do it quality. Quality construction. Well designed. Thinking about the experience of living in a house, how it's going to
Yeah.
affect the family, how it's going to affect your health. Those are all things that the builders never even consider. It's not part of their business plan.
Right, exactly. And you know, it's the fast the McMansions are the fast food of our, you know, of our industry, you know, and it's no surprise that they're called McMansions, you know.
Right,
I mean,
right.
it's like they literally are the McDonald's of you know, of houses. And you know, our philosophy is to build less but better. You know, build higher quality that's going to last a long time. That a lot of the single family homes and condos that I see going up all around, I mean, they're not going to last much more than 30 or 40 years. And so if you think about the waste of resources, you know, all the money and time that's spent to build these buildings that are going to last less than 50 years, and then they're just going to have to be torn down and rebuilt again. What a shame, you know, when we could just do it a little bit better and then end up with a 100-year, 200-year building, you
Right.
know, that will be around for that long. I mean, you know, like this is, we don't have limitless resources on our planet, you know, and if we're building fast and cheap, you know, then we're just going to be churning through these things, you know, at a pace much, much faster than it used to be.
Let's take a quick break here to say thank you to our platform sponsors here at Entree Architect, Arcat, FreshBooks, and Core by BQE Software. Your boss asks you to put together some CAD details for your firm's next project. What's your next step? What do? Is it using the basic internet search on your computer only to find outdated or incompatible details? Grabbing the details from your last project and hoping they fit in this project? There's an easier, faster, much less stressful way to get the information you need. Arcat.com. Arcat has over 15,000 CAD details based on real manufacturers' products and a powerful search engine to find just the right one that you're looking for. Best of all, it's free. You don't even have to register. You don't even have to give them your email address. Just go to entrearchitect.com/Arcat. Let them know that we sent you, and then start downloading all the CAD details that you need for free. entrearchitect.com/Arcat. FreshBooks. FreshBooks makes it simple to send invoices, post your expenses automatically. I love that. Track your time for your whole team by project and get organized with reports, communication, and notifications. My favorite feature in FreshBooks is the automated invoice reminders. I think sending invoices and getting paid is one of our biggest hurdles as entrepreneur architects. Who has time to get the invoices out and get paid, right? But if we don't send out invoices, we don't get paid. FreshBooks makes it easy to send out invoices and get paid online with the click of a button. I love this. And when your client doesn't pay you on time, and that's like every time, FreshBooks sends them a friendly email reminder through a simple system that you control. Sign up for a free 30-day unrestricted trial and get ready for the simplest way to be more productive, more organized, and most importantly, get paid faster. Visit entrearchitect.com/freshbooks to access FreshBooks for free, and be sure to enter Entree Architect in the How Did You Hear About Us section. BQE Core revolutionizes the way architects manage projects, time and expenses, billing, and accounting. Core brings every part of your business under one roof so you can stop switching between systems and get back to work on being an architect. Made by BQE, the company behind ArchiOffice, Core saves you time while giving you the visibility, the flexibility, and the power you need to grow your firm. Work from anywhere, seamlessly collaborate, and gain transformative insights with Core's groundbreaking platform. Learn more and get a free trial, 15 days free, at entrearchitect.com/BQE. Arcat, FreshBooks, and BQE Software. Visit our platform sponsors today and thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. How do you serve that that market that's looking for that developer house, that 6 month period, you know, that everybody's looking for. How do we do that if we slow down and build, you know, design a better house and build a better quality? How do we compete with builders?
Well, so one way is that first we have to change people's hearts and minds. So we need to educate them. Mm-hmm. First of all, you know, architects need to start taking a stand. We need to protest. I mean, the slow food guys, they went out and they protested the McDonald's, you know.
Right, right.
When was the last time you saw an architect protesting a McMansion?
Right.
Just
slow food, because I don't think you mentioned what slow food is. For anybody who doesn't know what slow food movement is, it's about fresh food. It's about local food. It's about seasonal food. It's about sort of the artisans. It's sort of going back to real food, you know, built, you know, from food that's grown within a certain limit of your place where you're going to cook it, and cooking real good food. And there's a whole movement of slow food. There's restaurants and there's now retail, and you know, Whole Foods is all built around all of that. And so it's that's the idea of the slow food movement. And I think that was probably the first slow movement, right?
It was.
And then
yeah.
there's lots of inspired movements from slow food that sort of grew out of that, but none for architecture. And so your idea is to take that idea, that philosophy of slow food, and bring it to architecture, and bring it, sort of go back to the traditional way of building houses and designing them and the quality of those houses, and design them for 100-year homes and for families and who are going to, you know, grow their families in them and to build healthy homes and be able to, you know, calculate the savings by doing that. It might be a little bit more expensive. It might take a little bit more time, but ultimately you're not going to have tracks and tracks and tracks of houses that in 20 years are going to tear down and have to rebuild again, which is clearly what's going to have to happen with the houses that are being built today.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you. You just like sold it in a nutshell right there. That was perfect. And there's another really interesting part about the slow food movement, which is that it's about the sensual pleasures of eating and about the experience of sharing food around a table with loved ones. And that's the other part that's so great about and how well that translates into architecture in my mind, you know, and the kind of architecture that I love. It's about like connecting and being together and, you know, and enjoying the sensual pleasures of, you know, the sort of fully immersed experience of architecture. So, you know, and that's what's, you know, that's another essential part that's missing from, you know, big box stores, McMansions, strip malls and that kind of stuff. So, I mean, you don't feel anything.
Right, right, and that's essentially what makes it a movement, right? When I asked you that question, and you said, "Well, we're going to have to change the hearts and minds of people," we're essentially not competing with the builders. We're trying to convince the people who are buying those houses that those houses are wrong, that those houses are bad, they're unhealthy, they're temporary, and that there is an alternative, and that if they just look over here, and they just take a look at what we're doing, they may consider choosing a different alternate route. And if you can make a movement out of that, you can get a lot more people to take that shift and turn their head and look at the other way and turn their back to the builders.
Exactly. And, you know, I don't have any, you know, this is a long-term plan here.
Yep.
You know, the slow food movement started 30 years ago, but now Whole Foods is fully mainstream. Amazon bought it, right? You know, it's going to be delivered to your doorstep. So, you know, they succeeded.
Yeah, it doesn't get more mainstream than that.
No, it really doesn't. So they succeeded. And, you know, organic food, farm to table. I mean, I could artisanal cheese, craft beer. Yeah. I could go on and on with all the things that, like, we now kind of take for granted that they were championing at the beginning. But it takes a long time. And I have, you know, preconceptions that this is like it's a slow movement, you know, no problem. I'm in it for the long haul. So back to the three tenets. Which are good, clean, and fair. And again, I borrowed them from slow food because again, I don't know what I'm doing as an activist, you know? And so they seem to work out just fine for them and they seem to apply just fine to our industry.
Yep.
So good is good design, you know, around human-centered design, around empathy. Beauty is critical. Nobody's going to take care of an ugly building. It must be beautiful. And that, I mean, when I was in architecture school, nobody would talk about beauty. They just refuse to talk about it. But it used to be that was what we were specialists in, was beauty. So it has to be there. So, and then clean. Okay. So clean is kind of a different take on the sustainability movement. It's not so much about energy efficiency, because you can get a really great R value with your spray foam insulation. But when two guys show up in a hazmat suit to install it,
right,
don't you just wonder? Doesn't that make you go,
Yeah.
Right? Like, this is not clean. You know, you really want to live inside of a spray foam bubble. You know, they don't tell you that 5 to 10% of the cases, the stuff never cures properly and it off gases forever. And that's the equivalent of having your car totaled because you can't get that stuff off. Right. And so, you know, it's just like another one of those things where like, oh, lead paint, that was a great idea once. Asbestos, that was a great idea once. You know, it's like, let's not over fetishize the new and the, you know, the silver bullet of, oh, there's this great new building product. Guess what? The building products we've been using for thousands of years, like wood, they work great. And we've got the data to prove it, you know, over thousands of years. It's like tried and tested. So we're thinking about clean, you know, what, like, it's the, yeah, like speaking of lead, it's like the use your children as a theoretical test case. Would you let your kids eat it? You know,
yep.
Because they eat lead paint, right?
Right.
They actually flavored it so that it would taste good. Oh. And, you know, but it's like, all right, yeah, I'd let my kid chew on a stick, like some wood. Okay, you know, it's pretty benign. Spray foam insulation? I don't think so. You know, it's like, if you wouldn't eat it, like, do you really want to live in it? And so I'm just looking for, like, common sense, a common sense approach that is, you know, not so reliant on checklists and data sheets and you know, a lot of big data heavy stuff. Like, let's just be kind of commonsensical about it and about what we build with and like what's in that stuff. So we're looking critically at what are all the regular things that we build with all the time. We were just doing some research into gypboard. Did you know that 90% of the gypboard produced worldwide is sold in the US?
No.
So what's everybody else using? And are we the fools? We might be, right?
Very, like, interesting, yeah.
Very interesting. Yeah, we need to question some of these things that we just take for granted, right? That's like, oh, yeah, well, that's standard practice. It's like, oh, but why? Anyway, so clean is about literally like clean, like natural and non-toxic materials. And then fair is another thing that is very, I'm very passionate about, because labor exploitation in the construction industry is huge, especially in residential construction. And some, there's been some highlighting of that in abroad in Middle Eastern countries where they have migrant labor that comes in from other countries, and they're basically like kept in workers' detention camps, you know, in the middle of the desert, working 20-hour days without water, you know, in horrible conditions. But guess what? That stuff happens here too, even though we have laws. I mean, if your builder uses day laborers, that's basically the same as they're paying them under the table. They're not on the books, and they're not paying into the Social Security system. They're not paying. There's no workers' comp. There's no unemployment insurance. When those workers get hurt, they're out of luck. And a lot of times a lot of the production builders are very guilty of this. A lot of times, their wages will be withheld, and the workers are told, "Hey, you better come back to the job tomorrow, or else you're not going to get paid." And their wages are withheld for weeks, months, and they're preying on the already sort of powerless. You know, oftentimes the workers may be undocumented. They may be documented. They may be U.S. citizens. You know. But they're being exploited, and the entire the entire bar is lowered for the construction industry, which could be such a phenomenal source of great middle class jobs. But, people need to be paid a living wage. And once people get or start to be paid a living wage, you're going to see changes all throughout, throughout the entire industry. I mean, you're not going to be able to build a 4,000 square foot house if you're actually paying people what they should be paid to build it. You might be able to afford a 2,000 square foot house for the same money. So less but better, better materials, fair labor. We need fair trade construction materials, right? Have you ever heard of that? No, never heard of
No,
it.
I've
We
heard fair trade food.
fair trade food. So don't we need fair trade construction materials because there are because the zinc that is mined and pick any ore, it doesn't matter what it is mined. We're t like by children in Africa crawling into tunnels in totally unsafe conditions, basically child slave labor to get the zinc for your zinc-coated copper panels for your building. Is that okay? Like, can we really accept that? And, we can say that, oh, well, the government's supposed to regulate that kind of stuff. And, we know that will never happen. And we're actually on the front lines as architects because we're specifying the products. And so, we can make a difference. We can say, no, that's not okay. And the easy one for right now for your listeners is FSC certified wood. Please use FSC certified wood. That's the only thing that comes close to being a fair trade building product out there. The only thing with a kind of chain of custody, where labor is also factored into it. So please use that. And then other than that,
And
other than
there's a website for FSC materials, right? Where you can actually see who's selling it, and there's labels for it, and
there's
so
labels
it's
for it.
easily documented.
It's easily documented. Even Home Depot sells FSC certified plywood. So, that's like a no-brainer. Everything else is like a market that needs to be created. And, this is capitalism at its best. We can create that market. If we create the demand, somebody will fill it. But we need to create the demand. And so it needs to come from us. And, your clients, you need to educate them. You say, do you really want to, get that tropical hardwood that not only is depleting the rainforest, but was also harvested by slaves? Oh, I don't know. Yeah, that's kind of a tough sell. It's like, but there's just nobody's talking about it. And so that's part of my mission, and that's part of the movement as
So
well.
how do we keep the movement moving? How is there are there you have the your website, slowspace.org. That's your blog, and that's all about the movement itself. Is there a way for listeners to be able to get involved and help you keep moving the movement?
Yeah, that would be great. And so maybe well, is to sign up for the blog. So I'll send you an email when a new blog post comes out. There's also a Facebook page that's facebook.com/slowspacemovement. So you can join there. I'm open to suggestions. I mean, the best thing I can do right now is just sort of spread the word and get people to start talking about things. And that's what the value of this podcast is for me, is that, we can get these ideas out there to more people. And the more people that start talking about it, the more people that start asking the question, oh, do you have any fair trade construction materials? Huh? What's that? Like, oh, I don't know. Like, three people just asked me about that last week. This is how change happens in the US, right? It doesn't happen from the
It's right
top
now,
down.
it's this gigantic ball the size of a house, and you're pushing on it. And
I'm
you
pushing.
need and you need a few more people to help you push that ball
Definitely.
to get it to move, because once that thing starts moving, it's not going to stop. And
It's not going to stop.
it's not going to take a whole lot of us to get it to move. And
Right.
so it's slowspace.org is this is where you can go and learn all about it. You can subscribe there. All of the social media is there as well, up in the top right corner at slowspace.org. You can see Meta's website, Meta, what is it? It's omotplum.com is the website. And you can find Meta all over social media. I follow her on Twitter. It's Meta Omot. And let me spell that so everybody knows, because it's not spelled the way it sounds. It's MetteAAModt. And that'll be on the show notes. This is episode 212. So entrearchitect.com/212. And we'll have links to everything. So if you just go there to entrearchitect.com/episode212, we'll have links to slowspace.org and the website and all of the social media and everything that we need there. So I applaud you. I commend you. I thank you. It's a worthy cause, and it's definitely something that I'm very interested in. It's sort of the way I never sort of formulated it. I never really thought about it as a movement or how you design, but it's the way I like to design. It's, you know, like I said, I live in a house that was built in 1934. This is that house that you're talking about. It was that house before the war. That's the way they built them.
That's the way they were. Yep. Then something happened in the 70s and everything went to shit.
Yeah. Yeah. And we can get it. We can get it back. It'll take us a lot of time. It'll be slow.
But if we
all sort of take it one step at a time. And I love the idea of sort of just not because we are always talking about in the group at entrearchitect.com/group, the Facebook group. We're always talking about how do we compete with the builders? How do we change the builders? But you're saying don't change the builders.
You can't change them.
Give the consumer an alternative. Give them something that's better that they can go and find and live in, and they'll see the value in the smaller house. Maybe it's a little bit more expensive per square foot. And there's lots of pieces. Like, it's a big movement, right? Because then you start thinking about the real estate agents, because you have to change the minds of the real estate agents too on the way they're going to sell those houses, because they're selling, you know, three bedrooms, two bathrooms, you know, it's all about the square footage. It doesn't matter that you never hear an architect design house or the value of an architect design
house.
You
do in Europe, though. You hear that on, in a real estate listings, it'll say right there, architect designed house. And that has a value. It doesn't have a value here.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for hanging out here with me, sharing your story, and all of the hard work that you're doing. I love your architecture, so I definitely I hope everybody goes and checks out your architecture just purely as design. I think it's beautiful.
Thank you.
And definitely go check out slowspace.org. Meta Omot, thank you very much for joining me here and sharing your knowledge at Entree Architect Podcast.
Oh, it was my pleasure, Mark. Thank you so much.
So before we wrap up here, I have three more items to share. Number one, share this episode with a friend. entrearchitect.com/episode212. That's entrearchitect.com/episode212. That's the episode to share. We are growing because you're sharing. That's the only way this is happening. So just take a few seconds, just type out entrearchitect.com/episode212. Send it to a friend, either email or Facebook or Twitter, and tag me in social media. Tag me so I know that you're sending it. I know you are, because this podcast is growing every month. The numbers are going up, and the only way that's happening is by you sharing it. But tag me. I want to know. I want to thank you. So do that. entrearchitect.com/episode212. Number two, if you like the Entree Architect podcast, I have two other podcasts that I want you to add to your playlist. You will love these shows: ArchiSpeak Podcast and Inside the Firm. You may already be listening to them. If you're not, put them on your playlist. ArchiSpeak Podcast is hosted by our friends Cormac Phelan, Neil Pan, Evan Troxell, three guys. They are fantastic. Where I focus on business and leadership and life as a small firm architect, they talk about everything, what it's like to be an architect. They talk about all of the profession, the good and the bad. They share it all. They always entertain, and I always learn something new that I didn't know. So definitely check out ArchiSpeak Podcast. And my friends Lance Psycho and Alex Gore over at Inside the Firm Podcast, they are crushing it. These guys are awesome. The guys at Arcaspeak and I launched around the same time back in late 2012. So we've been around for a long time now, 5+ years inside the firm, are the new boys in town. They've been around for about 1.5 years online at inside the firm. And every show brings value. They've formatted their show into separate segments. And so they sort of talk about one thing and they sort of talk about being an entrepreneur architect. And they do a reading and they do ARE hacks game show. Very, very entertaining. I love it. And I have a playlist of about 20 podcasts that I download each week, but I only listen to about 8 of them consistently every week. I listen to more than that, but 8 of them, I'm on it every week. I listen to every episode. These are the podcasts that educate me. They inspire me. They entertain me. These are the shows that I never miss, these 8. And both Arcaspeak and Inside the Firm are on that list. So I encourage you to add both of those shows to the top of your playlist right now. And 3, this is important. This may change your life as a small firm architect. It's something that will help you build all those important business systems that will make your firm run smoothly. They'll make you more money. It's something that will make you more efficient, more effective, more productive. I want you to go check out Entree Architect Foundations. It's a collection of more than 50 business forms and checklists designed and built specifically for small firm architects. You can learn more about them at entrearchitect.com/foundations. These are the documents that I built for my own firm. These are my documents, and it took me more than 20 years to build this valuable library of resources, and it's the foundation of my success. This collection includes documents for business administration, design development, project management, construction management, my sales system, and complete project organization. It has everything that I need to run my firm. Whether you've just started your firm or you've been in business for decades, these are the documents you need to make your business systems purr. Learn more at entrearchitect.com/foundations. Go check them out right now. It will change the way you do business. entrearchitect.com/foundations. My name is Mark Arlepage, and I thank you for being here. I'm an entrepreneur architect, and I encourage you to build a better business so you can be a better architect. Love, learn, share what you know. Thanks for listening. Have a fantastic week.